Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So, doctor, if I could only get an image, a picture taken of my joint, it would tell me what's going wrong with my joint. Many people present in pain and they want to understand where that pain is coming from. And they're hoping that imaging is going to be the answer to their question. And specifically, more often than not, what I would call higher order imaging, such as magnetic resonance imaging or MRI. Today's conversation is really targeting that particular abuse and overuse of imaging, and looking specifically at the clinical utility of what we do. So why do we do imaging and how frequently it's occurring, the inappropriate use and overuse, and the consequences and harms of doing too much imaging and the costs associated with that. It's a really complex conversation. It's one that has massive implications for our healthcare system, particularly costs and unnecessary interventions and what we might consider the overuse of medicine or abuse of medicine. And something that I don't necessarily have a complete crystal clear answer for, but I think it's incredibly important for you as a community of people that has osteoarthritis or who help people with osteoarthritis to appreciate the challenges that are faced here and at least consider some of the solutions to these complex problems. And we're really fortunate to have a close colleague, really eloquent musculoskeletal radiologist, James Linklater, come along and talk to us on today's episode of Joint Action. James is a radiologist and he's the chief executive officer of Castle Ray Imaging. And he's got particular skills in all aspects of musculoskeletal imaging and intervention and has ongoing research interests in imaging of osteoarthritis and also imaging of ACL, cruciate ligament reconstructions. Hello, James. Welcome to the show.
Afternoon, David.
It's good to see you at least remotely online. And I think I probably see you online despite the fact that our workplaces are probably 50 meters apart more frequently than I do in person. But anyway.
That's the 21st century for you, isn't it?
Can you share with the listeners a little bit more about your background and what a typical day looks like?
Yeah, I'm what is referred to as a musculoskeletal radiologist, and I sort of subspecialize in that area. And so my training was in medicine, and then I went on to specialize in diagnostic radiology, and subsequently did a fellowship in musculoskeletal radiology in a facility in New York, and returned to Australia and work in a private practice environment. And Australia is interesting insofar as most musculoskeletal radiology occurs in a private practice setting. And so the opportunity to have an interesting career in that space really is created by working in private practice, which is what I've been doing for the last 25 years or so. And my day is spent seeing patients, consulting with them, helping make decisions with them about what interventional treatments might be helpful for their current problems, reviewing patients' imaging and reporting on them, discussing cases with referring doctors, And also, I'm involved in the running of our practice here in St. Leonard's. And I have two fellows in musculoskeletal radiology who I'm training this year. So I've spent a reasonable amount of my day going through cases with them and discussing the nuances that are involved in interpreting musculoskeletal imaging, discussing a little bit about the pitfalls of low-value imaging. And then I'm also the CEO of business Castle Ray Imaging. So there's a bit of background commercial aspect to my day as well. I'm fortunate that we have a very highly competent chief operating officer for our business. So the day-to-day operations are well taken care of, and I'm able to focus most of the time on the clinical aspects of my practice.
Fantastic. And obviously the perspectives that you're giving today, I guess I'm seeking your input as a musculoskeletal radiologist, because I would appreciate, as the CEO of an imaging company, there might be some incentives or motivations to potentially increase income, not necessarily always at the best benefit of patient care. But again, I'm probably pushing you too far already.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to open that door of perverse incentive, and I think, you know, that's it's possibly not confined to radiology. You know, it's something which is part and parcel of the medical system that we work with. And it's interesting you raise that, because the company I work for is very much aligned with the concept of medical leadership, and that's front and center, and makes it almost unique. And it's quite an amazing story of a company which started in 1993 as a $10 million company, and is now a $16 billion company. And the amazing thing about it is that it's really built on the concept of medical leadership, and an understanding that if you pursue an approach which is designed to deliver quality care to patients, that will result in a successful business. And it's been remarkably successful. And our global CEO, Colin Goldschmidt, is really, you know, it's an amazing testimony to his vision. And we're lucky to be part of that. And I'm very comfortable with that environment. And we're committed to that approach, that you provide care for your patient, and in the long run, you'll have a successful business. So I guess what that can look like is having a conversation with a patient about a procedure they've come for, where you say, well, this may not be the best thing for you to have done.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic to hear. And as you say, potentially a little bit unique in medicine, where I think a lot of the business clouds what's optimal as far as care, and particularly the reimbursement incentives, are structured very much around volume, not necessarily quality. But before we get too much into the content of hopefully where we'll go, can you just describe a little bit about, when you're not at work, what do you enjoy doing?
Well, it's as you can see from my large forehead, David, I'm not in the full bloom of youth. And what I enjoy doing when I'm not working has changed over time. I used to love surfing. I spent a lot of time out in the water, and found that really enjoyable, and connecting with nature. And in the last few years, I've kind of morphed into really loving gardening and bush regeneration. That was my COVID journey, really, is working on my property and clearing out the weeds and visioning what bush regeneration looks like, and learning a lot, and coming from a place where I knew nothing. And it gives me a lot of joy. You know, it's a very different perspective to think about gardening and creating things that will be there long after I'm dead, and this connection with nature, connection with land. And yeah. So that gives me a lot of joy. I've taken up singing, which I was always told I wouldn't be a singer, but been doing the last few years doing some gospel singing workshops, which has been a lot of fun. I wouldn't say I'm a good singer, but I enjoy it. Again, it's good for the soul.
Oh, that's... The important thing is that you enjoy it, not necessarily the people's ears around it may feel the same way that you do, but as long as you're having a good time, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think I'm a firm believer everyone can sing. It's just a matter of being able to listen to the tune.
Yeah, yeah. Now, James, if you had to describe yourself in 5 words, what would they be?
Well, if I'm meeting someone who I haven't met before, I usually say I'll be the tall, bald guy. And I was described, I spent a year doing medical research in Burma, and my nickname there was Young Smiling One. And perhaps I can morph into the old smiling one now. So there are a few descriptors maybe that might suffice, David.
Wonderful. And I guess back to that first question where you were just telling us about your what a typical day looks like and what your background is. Just for the listeners, I do try to get James to cross to the dark side from time to time of medical research and academia, and he's kind enough to oblige us on a pretty regular basis. And I guess the reason for bringing that up now is we were fortunate enough to co-supervise a wonderful young chap from Myanmar whose focus was on musculoskeletal ultrasound, but he's now gone back to that country. And we've now got a similarly talented young man from now Bangladesh that we're co-supervising. But again, before I digress too much, the main focus of today's conversation really is about the challenges of both, I guess, appropriate ordering and investigation of imaging in the context of osteoarthritis. Now, we've had other episodes in the past where we've spoken about the fact that the diagnosis for osteoarthritis is a clinical one. And so that is, if you want to go back and listen to it, a conversation we had with Tahina Nyoji, but essentially by a clinical one, it means based upon a constellation of historical features, so questions that you ask a patient and some salient features on a clinical examination. And imaging typically gets restricted to those indications where it's unclear what the diagnosis may be. James, I wonder if we could start just by talking a little bit about what different types of imaging are available in the context of osteoarthritis investigation if we were to require some form of investigation.
Well, the oldest and probably most prevalent or most widely available investigation is an X-ray. And that provides a means of demonstrating some features of osteoarthritis, and usually on the basis of a joint space getting narrowed and the body's response to damage to the joint of forming spurs or osteophytes, and the bone getting harder to cope with the fact that the normal shock absorbers in the joint aren't working so well. And sometimes picking up some calcification in the joint that might be associated or incidentally present. And that's been the most widely used imaging test for the investigation of osteoarthritis. And with the last 30, 40 years, we've seen the proliferation of a number of other imaging tests which will elegantly demonstrate structural changes in joints that have osteoarthritis. So you can demonstrate on MRI, which doesn't use ionizing radiation. It uses a strong magnetic field and looks at the behavior of protons in those tissues. You can demonstrate the loss of the articular cartilage, which is the layer which lines the joints and ensures their normal smooth glide. You can demonstrate changes in the adjacent bone, which might reflect overload of the bone or some sclerosis in the bone. And you can demonstrate joint fluid, the inflammation in the fluid, inflammation in the adjacent soft tissues. And it's been interesting from the point of view of trying to work out what the pain generator is in osteoarthritis. And that's a broader conversation, I guess, and it certainly has been a frustrating one for us as imagers, the lack of connection between what we see on imaging and patient symptoms. So we could see a patient who has quite advanced osteoarthritis on the basis of structural assessment who has no symptoms. It's been well documented that's the case. And you can also have patients who have relatively mild changes of osteoarthritis who have a lot of symptoms. And those symptoms, oftentimes the pattern of osteoarthritis is, as I'm sure you've covered, David, many times, that it will wax and wane. And if you repeat that imaging test down the track when the symptoms have waned and the imaging may well look the same. I'm particularly interested in identifying, well, the idea of whether imaging can identify the causes of pain and whether it's a soft tissue related inflammatory type change that might be amenable to some sort of local treatment, or it's a bone pain related sort of scenario. But the fact is that if one's nihilistic about it, that a lot of this imaging is not going to make a difference to the management of the patient. And that's probably the germane point here.
Yeah. And so I guess just to really recap some really valuable and important insights you provided there. So one is about the lack of correlation between what imaging demonstrates and the symptoms that a person experiences. And as James said, that's been known and shown by a number of different studies over a lot of years. And potentially as a consequence of that, the clinical utility of obtaining imaging and influencing management is diminished, both as a consequence of its lack of relation to what a patient feels, but also because of the lack of available therapies that are actually going to modify the course of disease, which we potentially could monitor or measure using imaging as a modality. And so it's in that context that, you know, where, and James, please feel free to disagree with this. In general, we still advocate that the diagnosis be a clinical one, so based upon a good history and a good examination, and that plain imaging may be required as the first modality. And by plain imaging, I'm just talking about an X-ray, and for the knee, that might be ideally a weight-bearing X-ray, as the first modality that we would acquire if there was some uncertainty about that diagnosis and some question about it, and potentially there's a likelihood that this could be a different type of arthritis or gout or a pseudogout, another type of inflammatory arthritis that might increase the likelihood that that's there, and by so doing, raise the possibility that that imaging has some utility. But James, in your, and so by all means, please disagree with anything that I just said there, but if in your clinical practice, do you see people coming along that are having an image requested by a referring physician that you think is inappropriate? And how frequently might you see that? And what do you typically do in that instance?
Yeah, so this afternoon I reviewed a case with my fellows that was a patient in their 60s who had medial knee pain and had been referred by their GP for an MRI. It wasn't uncovered under Medicare, and they had widespread osteoarthritis and decent-sized medial joint line osteophytes and decent effusion synovitis and a chronically torn meniscus. And the discussion I had with my fellows was, well, this is an example of low-value imaging. And the scan had been done. The patient paid for it, and we've confirmed the extent of pathology, and the patient on a structural basis. I've seen patients who had a knee replacement who had less advanced osteoarthritis than I saw in that scan. What did I do about it? Well, I discussed it with my fellows. I didn't ring the GP and say to them, there may not have been a lot of point of doing this, and if you'd examined the patient thoroughly, you probably could have confidently made that diagnosis. And that's partly a function of the amount of time I have in my day to spend with those sorts of interactions. And most of the interactions I have with clinicians are when there's a problem, they want to work out what sort of imaging modality is appropriate, or they're just trying to work out whether an intervention is appropriate. We do provide some educational events for GPs to discuss the investigation and management of various musculoskeletal problems, and we try and provide information on that. I think a lot of this is community driven, that there's a transposition from watching the footy on a Friday night and hearing that the footballer is going off to get their MRI scan to think, well, I need to go and get an MRI scan. And I think the other thing which is increasingly prevalent is a sense that if I'm not completely normal, then I'm broken and I need to be fixed. And there's not an understanding that it's common to have structural changes which are not causing a problem, and that the natural cycle of osteoarthritis is that it will wax and wane, and that with appropriate measures you can get to that period, that situation where it's not symptomatic, not troubling the patient, but the scan or the images will still look abnormal. And I think that's the big gap, is the sense in our community that if things need to be fixed, and what by fixing means, you know, some kind of operation or a procedure or something. Often it's the hard work of weight loss and exercise that is the path to actually addressing the underlying problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so as you say, it's a very complex situation. But really, just to echo what James is saying, is that the frequency with which imaging gets requested in the context of primary care, and this comes from data from the Beach and other large general practice databases, outrates and is more frequent than any other intervention that a GP actually does. And so it's more common than a referral to a physical therapist, to an orthopedic surgeon, for an injection, whatever it might be. So the imaging is the thing that is requested most frequently in the context of managing a person that has osteoarthritis. What's the concern? Why are we having this conversation? What's the harm of just rampantly doing as much imaging as we can? And what are the downsides as far as patient care is concerned and quality?
Well, I guess, you know, history is always instructive, isn't it, David? And this sort of concept of being fixed and structural, addressing structural abnormality, it's been, I think, quite conclusively shown now that in patients with osteoarthritis, that arthroscopy is not effective in the long-term progress of a patient with osteoarthritis. And in fact, I think there's some data to suggest that there can be an acceleration in that osteoarthritic process with those sorts of interventions. Potentially, doing more imaging can feed into that process. And I think that over the last 10 years, there's been a significant change in awareness of these issues, and I think probably a significant change in practice, which is probably still in evolution. But I think that's, so that's one level, is the outcome for the individual patient, that it can lead to interventions which are not in the long-term benefit of the patient.
Yeah. And so just to put a number on that. So we did a small study, and this has been replicated by others internationally, that suggested that in a population of people with knee osteoarthritis, some of whom had a knee x-ray, but a comparator group had an MRI, all of whom had knee osteoarthritis, all of whom had symptomatic disease, those people that had the MRI were 10 times more likely to receive a surgical intervention. And, you know, there are many limitations with the way we did the analysis, but the surgical intervention we're talking about here is the one that you just described, specifically a knee arthroscopy, which we categorically know is of no benefit to patient care long-term or the health of the knee longer-term similarly. So that's the potential harms. Just while we're touching upon that, there's a couple of acronyms that you like to throw around. I was just wondering if you could share those with us. In this context.
Yeah. And look, full disclosure, I've had a knee arthroscopy I'm 59, and I think I had the arthroscopy when I was 53 for a displaced flap tear of my medial meniscus. And so I lost 10 degrees of extension, and I started getting hip pain and back pain. And I've got some early degenerative changes in that knee, not bad. I had a very good outcome from that arthroscopy, and that was probably about 5 years ago now. So there is nothing is black and white, and this is the concept of individualized medicine. I'll just say that for full disclosure.
Just before you go into the acronyms then, what's the frequency with which someone has a locked knee, so to speak, or an inability to fully extend the knee? Because that is the indication we're really talking
about. Yeah. And look, it's not common. It is not common.
Yeah.
And good to make that point. And this kind of feeds into the concepts of vomit and barf. Now, radiology is unfortunately full of acronyms, and vomit is sort of a patient-focused podcast, David, I believe, and it's pretty germane to bring it up, which is VOMIT stands for Victim of Medical Imaging Technology, VOMIT. And then BARF is the brainless application of radiologic findings. And the two kind of work together, not necessarily what we'd call a synergistic way, but they can sort of collide in an unfortunate fashion. And it feeds back into the concept that as we age, there are a number of structural abnormalities which will develop in our musculoskeletal system. And a lot of them are incidental and not relevant to whatever a patient may have in the way of symptoms. And part of the art of musculoskeletal radiology is trying to discern what's relevant and what's background noise, you know, the so-called red herring versus the important clue. And I was actually musing on the fact that I think AI is going to take quite a long time to actually kind of sort through all that. And I would say to you that a good musculoskeletal radiologist will attempt to integrate the clinical information, the imaging findings, and provide some kind of interpretation on what's relevant and what's not. But we can also give a laundry list of abnormalities without a lot of context. And then the patient who will get to read that report will say, my goodness, I've got this 15 things wrong with my knee. This is terrible. I've got to do something about it. Can someone please fix me? And it may be that someone might offer some kind of intervention to fix that problem, or even believe that they are all causing the patient symptoms. And that's where you can get the bath on top of the vomit. and we do see it does occur, unfortunately. And you know, we laugh about it, but you know, beneath the, someone said humor is tragedy plus time, and
the long laundry list, which sometimes I've heard described as the war zone of the knee on an MRI report. Once a person's seen that, it's really hard to unsee that report. If you're a person who has that knee that's being reported on, and as you've just mentioned, the inclination from those people is to want to get that fixed, so to speak, to have something done about it, which typically ends up in a surgical intervention. So outside of the potential consequences or harms, what are the costs that we're typically talking about here? And I know it's going to vary dramatically by different types of practice and imaging modality, but I just wonder if you could give a ballpark cost for what typically would be charged or by Medicare and or typical practice costs for X-ray, ultrasound, CT, and MRI.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that MR that I spoke to you before, that would have cost the patient $250. An X-ray, because that MRI was not covered by Medicare, an X-ray will generally be covered by Medicare and will be of the order of $40 cost to Medicare and thus us as a community. A CT scan is going to be of the order of a couple hundred dollars. An MRI scan is about $340. The government has taken some steps to try and reduce the spend on MRI of the knee and by limiting access in various ways, but you can still get a specialist referral for a MRI of the knee in someone who might have advanced osteoarthritis, and there may well be a good clinical reason for doing that. And oftentimes there will. So if say a surgeon is trying to work out whether a patient is a candidate for a joint replacement of the whole knee or just half the knee, that can help their decision-making process. But the net effect, I can't give you a number on the global spend in the community, but I would say that it's not insubstantial. We see ultrasound examinations being performed, which are almost universally inappropriate in this context. And then that's of the order of $100. And then not to mention then time spent from a patient away from their workplace to go and get these tests done. And then review them with their referring doctor and so on, the cost of the consult with him, et cetera. So it's it's not insignificant.
Yeah. And, it, you know, as James said before, when we were talking about the role of arthroscopy, nothing is ever black and white. And so obviously when we're talking about imaging in this context, it's important to recognize that in some instances, particularly where the diagnosis is unclear or you strongly suspect another differential, that it is appropriate to go off and get imaging. But where it's a what we otherwise call barn door diagnosis that's obvious from when the person walks in the room, the rationale for that is often markedly diminished. So we know that imaging gets overused. We know that there are consequences associated with that and substantial costs. So what can be done to enhance the appropriate use of imaging and potentially also to reduce overuse? A moment ago, you mentioned restriction to certain medical groups, but I wonder if you could expand on opportunities like that and what actually happened there and what it led to.
So within Australia, we have a system where there is some restriction of access to funding for MR examinations. And initially, the government brought in a system of funding which required that referrals had to be from a specialist to be funded under Medicare. And then subsequent to that, they brought in a regime where general practitioners could refer patients for MRIs of the brain, of the cervical spine, and the knee. And there was a significant increase in volume of imaging of the knee subsequent to that with MRI. And the government sort of noticed that and reached a decision that they would restrict access for that reason for patients referred by a GP to patients under 50 who had a history of trauma and were suspected of either having a torn anterior cruciate ligament or a torn meniscus. And the rationale being that they're worthwhile diagnoses to make in the, after acute trauma, and that the obverse of someone who has a history of pain, knee pain and stiffness with no specific injury, that there's no point in funding that sort of examination. But I think that was a sensible decision from the government. I think it has had some impact on the degree of inappropriate imaging. I think it's not easy, though, to have that sort of gatekeeper type approach and to police that in an effective fashion. And I think that the bigger picture is one of community awareness and education for the healthcare professionals who are involved in the care of patients with these musculoskeletal conditions.
And so to that end, what can be done about, I guess, improving health professional knowledge and education here and or the community understanding of perceptions of the role and importance of imaging outside of medical education? So, I mean, we had the musculoskeletal block recently. I told the medical students about all of what we're talking about today. And I think they got the message. But obviously that's going to take generations for that to come into practice. So what can we do to educate health professionals?
Well, I mean, here we are, David. It may be that there are some health professionals listening. I suspect they'll have their own confirmation bias already, so I don't think that their opinions will be changed. I don't think it's an easy process. I really don't. I think it's a gradual process of building awareness. You know, in so many other aspects of the community as well, these things don't change overnight. And it's hard to touch base with all areas of the community. There are some aspects of the community who are more interested in these issues and will be better informed and take a more considerate approach. And we're invested in education throughout our company. And there's a musculoskeletal imaging association within Australia and New Zealand, which is committed to providing education in this sort of space as well. There's committees which you and I have been involved in that have been helping formulate guidelines for GPs for the diagnosis and management of osteoarthritis. So I think they all add layers to something which hopefully will change direction, but none of these things will change overnight.
Yeah. What role, if any, does the radiologist have here? And here I'm particularly thinking about what they say in their reports and how they structure their reports. What role is there?
Well, you know, as I said, I think it's our role is to contextualize and to try and sort the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. But there are technical aspects, as you alluded to, like obtaining weight-bearing x-rays. They're more meaningful because they'll show joint space loss. So if you're going to do an x-ray, at least do a good one. And then there's something which I'm sure you've seen, David, which I kind of refer to as being, would you like fries with that kind of radiology, where there's a sort of a throwaway line at the end that perhaps a cortisone injection would be helpful if clinically indicated or something along those lines, which occasionally that's appropriate, but I think oftentimes those statements come in the context of a lack of thorough knowledge of the clinical situation, and they're probably not totally appropriate.
What, I mean, just coming back to the war zone description I mentioned a moment ago and the hierarchical structuring of a conclusion, there's at least some suggestions that, you know, we basically have a bolded sentence at the beginning of that conclusion statement that this person has knee osteoarthritis, and particularly for higher order imaging, so MRI in particular, taking this high road, so to speak, that this could have been adequately diagnosed based upon a plain x-ray. So just to, I guess, counsel within the context of the report and then have the laundry list of other war zone features underneath that. Is there any rationale, motivation for that?
Look, there's a few things that are interesting. I mean, I always teach my fellows, you know, osteoarthritis trumps meniscal tear. And, you know, in the conclusion, you put the osteoarthritis and then you probably don't even need to put in the degenerative meniscal tear in the conclusion. So there's that level of contextualizing as opposed to leading with the torn meniscus with a little unstable flap at the edge, which might draw focus to the things that are not relevant to the patient's problem. I think it's interesting as to whether there's a role for describing what is the prevalence of asymptomatic findings in various areas. So this particularly is probably more relevant to spine, where there's a high incidence of asymptomatic disc protrusions. We haven't done it, but I think there is potentially a role for just explaining that, to contextualizing that sort of prevalence of asymptomatic abnormalities. Saying something which is self-evident, I'd be reluctant to go down the road of saying this could have been diagnosed with an x-ray, because it was the question, was there arthritis or were they looking for a meniscal tear, etc. So I don't know that there's a huge role for that.
Yeah. I mean, just, obviously, so everybody out there is aware, when we're talking about the context of knee osteoarthritis and imaging, we know that a meniscal tear is a universal part of the knee osteoarthritis process. So at least in the epidemiologic studies, in excess of 90% of people that have knee osteoarthritis have a meniscal tear. And James, as you were saying before, there are similar community-based studies that have done MRIs and people without symptoms, without disease, that have shown that a lot of the structural features that we're talking about, meniscal tears, extrusion or subluxation of the meniscus, bone marrow lesions, tears of the cruciate ligament, are all incredibly frequent amongst an older community. And as indicated, not related to symptom presentation. So, you know, I think there's a lot that we need to work out. There's a lot for the professional societies, hopefully, to play a role here. But James, just wondering, is there any other comments that you wanted to make about the topic in closing before I get on to a couple of interrogative closing questions?
It's such a hugely common problem, and I know you've invested a huge amount of energy in your professional life, David, into trying to move forward in terms of finding treatments that are make a difference. And I've been involved in research projects with you where imaging has been really very interesting, and I think has made some interesting findings. And as always, there's a patient at the end of all these sort of problems, and I think that's probably the key point, is that we need our healthcare systems to look at the individual patient, look at their context, and work out what's best for them. And I think if we can move in that direction, that's going to move the impact outcomes for patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you said before, optimal patient care trumps everything. Yeah. Mm. So James, just in closing, why do you do what you do? What's your primary motivation?
I became a doctor because I am very altruistic, and I really enjoy what I do. I enjoy interactions with patients. I'm kind of nerdy. I like the technology in radiology. And I like, in particular, I like musculoskeletal radiology because it's kind of skewed towards the healthy segment of the community. I see a lot of sports injuries, and I see myself as helping people get back to a healthy lifestyle. And that's they're some of the reasons.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is that you're a wonderful person to have had the privilege of working with, both professionally, but at least from a personal level as well. We've had, I've at least had imaging done in your practice at least once, and I think at least large numbers of my family have been through the same practice and sought your input and insight. So it's highly valued and highly sought after. James, is there any one piece of advice, knowledge, or wisdom that you'd like to give for people that have osteoarthritis?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So much, I think, is related to there's this vicious cycle of being able to exercise and be able to tolerate the pain to exercise and to lose weight. And that I've often have those conversations with patients who I see, and it's not an easy conversation to have to highlight that, but I honestly think it's so important. That the two most important things is just trying to get some of the weight off and to find a way of strengthening muscle around these joints. I think it's the biggest thing.
Yeah. Great. It's a great way to close. And James, again, thank you so much for your honesty, your insights, all you bring in terms of the credibility to your field. It's highly valued, and I really, really do appreciate it, both at a personal and a professional level. So thank you.
Thanks very much, David. It's been a pleasure.
So this is obviously a complex and controversial area. The current data would suggest that imaging is getting vastly overused. And despite osteoarthritis being a clinical diagnosis, the frequency with which imaging gets done vastly outranks the frequency with which any other intervention or guidance for management occurs for people that have osteoarthritis. As alluded to in today's conversation, that has real harms, because obviously when you see the war zone of your MRI report, it's very hard to unsee that description. And more often than not, I completely understand why you might want something done about that. But oftentimes that leads to surgical intervention, such as an arthroscopy, which we know is not going to provide you a benefit in most instances and potentially cause your disease to progress more rapidly. It's associated with substantial cost, not only potentially to you, but to society as a whole. And so we know that that's happening. There are challenges in reducing that because, you know, blanket rules applied to healthcare professionals oftentimes limit appropriate use. And so what we're not saying here is, you know, there are instances where imaging would be appropriate, but in most instances where it's being used here, it's being overused and abused. Frequently, I see people come along and see me in my clinical practice with a CD or an MRI disc in their hand, and they say, "Doctor, please look at my images." And I say, as much as I would like to, it's not going to change the way I manage you. And until we have disease-modifying therapy available, I don't see how that's necessarily going to change the way I currently manage people. So it doesn't change management meaningfully and favorably, but it can lead to real harms. Hence my concern about its overuse and abuse and the costs associated with that. So again, a really complex, pithy issue, one that I hope we gave appropriate coverage to, and you've learned a little bit about some of the challenges in that particular topic. But irrespective, really appreciate your ongoing support of the Joint Action podcast. Between now and when we next have a chance to interact, please do take good care of yourself.
Thanks for listening to Joint Action with David Hunter. If you like our show and want to know more, visit www.jointaction.info. If you have any questions, you can email us at hello@jointaction.info and follow us on Twitter @jointaction.org. This podcast was hosted by David Hunter, edited by Vicky Duong, music produced by Jordan Hunter. The information posted on this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. Anyone seeking medical advice should consult a health professional.
Hold up. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.